The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show, and how are you today? I think everybody is energised by the fury and the outrage, aren't they? There's some weeks where you feel everybody's kind of depressed, which they say depression is anger turned in. So the anger's definitely turned out this week, and I think people are finding it quite cleansing in their own way, and they'll be more furious now reading the front of the Daily Mail today. And the Daily Mail, of course, broke that story yesterday about the Beacon Hospital giving the jobs to the St. George's, with the so-called posh private school. So today, the Mail has that the Beacon Hospital Chief Executive Michael Cullen personally phoned his children's private school to offer the staff COVID-19 vaccinations, the Irish Daily Mail can reveal. And, you know, you can understand the fury over this and the whole optics of privilege around it and everything. But you just wonder, it's kind of handy too for the HSE and the government to have this a very clear bogeyman here, isn't it? But like, are we kind of forgetting that this did happen because this wondrous HSE portal we've been hearing all about did on Tuesday anyway, it was spitting out two appointments for hundreds of people on Tuesday. So basically, it seems for some reason, it seems to have been a lot of psychotherapists getting their jabs on Tuesday, and they were all getting sent two appointments, one in the Aviva and one up in the Beacon. And then we heard one on Liveline yesterday saying she tried to get through to the HSE to say which appointment should I take, is one cancelling the other? And she ended up having a long conversation with them over Twitter. One person actually told me that she got the two appointments sent to her, texted to her. So she rang and she did get through to someone in the HSE. And they said to her, oh, look, we don't know, just go to whichever one suits you. So I suppose you hope there isn't a bigger question here. That was is there a glitch in the old system here? And was that a one-off or is it a systemic issue? Because we are gearing up to a million a month now. So the portal, I think, isn't it going, it's going to be live for everybody in the next week or two. So is it working properly? Is probably a bigger question than, you know, one man doing something asinine. The Irish Daily Star has that story as well. Beacon Hospital outrage, this will sting. Cancer victims wait as jab dished out to private school teachers. The Irish Independent have a very good point on their front page. Still no date for most of us to get COVID vaccine. You'd feel that if people could get some idea of when they might be getting the vaccine, that they might not be so angry, and it might, you know, give them something to aim at and something to look forward to. And you'd wonder if, based on the numbers they have now, which seem, you know, if they said, look, within reason, if we get the million a month for the next 3 months, that they could roughly tell people, OK, if you are like, you know, Brendan O'Connor, a man over 50, what month might I be getting it or something? I think people would feel a bit more kind of calm maybe and bought into things. The Irish Times has an interview with the new Irish country head for AstraZeneca. So he's not very helpful in giving us any certainty anyway. So the front page is, Ireland will receive a large volume of AstraZeneca vaccines in the coming weeks, the pharmaceutical firm's Irish president has said. I think we were kind of banking on that anyway. He declined to quote absolute numbers for the weeks ahead. So that's not hugely helpful anyway, but we'll be getting lots more. He also declined to apologise for the AstraZeneca not hitting their targets here. The Irish Daily Mail, Telecovad, shocker. A shock new TV ad will show COVID-19 victims fighting for their lives after making seemingly harmless decisions. I think that's a really good idea as well, because you can listen to all the scare stories and doctors telling you what to do and all that. But actually, sometimes it's when I go online and see a story on the Daily Mail website, or I see something on Sky News where they go into a ward and whatever, that would still give you the heebie-jeebies and make you be careful, you know. So just seeing people like you who didn't think they were going to get this and who didn't think they were going to get very sick. The Herald is leading with a man who harassed his pregnant ex-partner by calling her up 100 times a day and threatening to throw acid in her face. And he has been jailed for 5.5 years. And the Irish Sun, Ill Bill out of Corry, soap legend off screen for months. That's Bill Roach, who is 88, who plays Ken Barlow. People might have noticed he has not been on the show. So there you go. And we'll come back to some and all of that over the course of the weekend. But first, Professor Mary Horgan, President of the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland. Good morning.
Good morning.
And I should say you're also a consultant in infectious diseases in Cork University Hospital. You are a Professor of Medicine in UCC and you're a busy woman. This week also you gave Tony Fauci, you made him an honorary fellow of the College of Physicians. So you're kept going. We'll come back. I want to talk to you about Tony Fauci in a minute. But you are also, of course, a member of NPHET. And I know you're not here as a member of NPHET, but as the fella says, while I have you, can I ask you a few questions about where we find ourselves, maybe? There's already emails coming in, right? There's one here. An email says, Super Value in Carrigskeen is full of cars from other counties and holiday home shoppers. That's from a concerned Kerry resident. And, you know, anyone who's been around the school gate all week will know there's been a lot of talk about people decamping for Easter. Would you be, and I think a lot of people are thinking, well, my parents have been half jabbed or, you know, twice jabbed. And then people saying, oh, well, you know, my parents would rather we come and take the chance and all that. Would you be worried about Easter kicking everything off again, that people are going to start moving around?
Yeah, I would be worried about it. I suppose I'm talking from my perspective of being on the front line in January, yeah, which was fairly horrific. The last thing we want is people to be moving around the country and really bringing infection from an area where there's a lot of infection to more rural areas. We saw that at Christmas. It really stood out. You saw rural parts of Cork where we just didn't see infection in the first and second wave. All of a sudden, there was a lot of movement. And then with the variant, which was fuel to the fire, being brought in, I suppose something that stood out to me was a grandson who travelled from Dublin down to his family for Christmas, infected his mother, infected his grandparents and his grand-aunt, four of whom ended up under my care in hospital at Cork University Hospital. So
the whole family,
the variant is so infectious, I suppose the concern would be that about 40 to 50% of people with the infection have no symptoms at all. So it's really to think hard before you travel. If people just can hang on, you heard the good news that there will be more and more vaccines available. And the big thing is to try to get that jab in your arm as quickly as we can. So the more we can get vaccines into the country, yeah, the more we can protect people.
And,
so
and just this think is the message Ronan Glynn has been trying to hammer home as well, which is just wait and another little bit. So you're saying to people, absolutely don't travel over Easter.
Think before you travel, because you, yeah, could be that person with no symptoms at all that brings it into a community where they're vulnerable, or you're meeting, yeah, vulnerable relatives.
Compliance is becoming an issue now, isn't it? And we saw the new figures that the people from 5%, I think, to 11.5% of people are now visiting other people in their homes and stuff. It's starting to get messy again, isn't it?
Well, you know, we've been in a lockdown or severe restrictions for nearly probably about 3 months now. It's very difficult for people. I think the big, along with vaccination, it is becoming spring, summer. This infection is much, much less transmitted outdoors. Yeah. So we need to start thinking about outdoor living, how we can, you know, meet friends outdoors, how we can eat outdoors. And while, of course, there's rain in the country, there, yeah, are, with technologies, we can live outside much, much better.
And listen, I agree with you 100%. And it feels a bit like we're at the same place, having the same conversation as we were before the summer last year, where we largely didn't do much about putting in place much for people. And here we are again facing, and we're being told it's an outdoor summer, but should we be doing a bit more about it in terms of trying to facilities or a bit of creative thinking around,
yeah,
telling people how to
do it? Absolutely. And I think that, you know, communities locally should be thinking about how to live outdoors. Certainly down in Princes Street in Cork, they did outdoor. Claire Nash was instrumental in doing outdoor dining there, and it really, really worked. So I think now is the time to start, you know, building infrastructures outdoors so we can live outdoors. I mean, it aligns with our climate green agenda also. So, you know, perhaps closing off streets as they did in Princess Street, in other towns and indeed cities outside around the country, and really incentivizing people to do that, letting the onus on businesses in communities to see how they can adapt to what we will be living for, not like it is as bad as it is or was a few months ago, but let's be creative. That's what we Irish are good at. We have a beautiful country and we should be using it.
Yeah,
like
and I know you're quite a positive, optimistic person about all this. Do you know, at the moment, I think we talked about living with COVID a long time ago and that didn't survive contact with the enemy, really. But you kind of do feel that we do have to grapple with the living with COVID a bit, don't we? But then on the other hand, I suppose you look at Poland, Germany, France today, all saying hospitals could be overwhelmed and, you know, they're now being hit with the B117.
Yeah.
Can we live with it at the moment?
We can live with it. I think people need to understand what the fundamental issue is here. It's the impact on our hospital service. So it's trying to protect that hospital service so people don't get into hospital with serious COVID or indeed die with it. So that's why we have to prioritise the groups most at risk of coming into hospitals, because if we can do that, then we can open up our services. We can safely and sustainably open up our community. But that is the fundamental issue, is our health service.
So you would be of the opinion that if we get the hospital numbers and ICU numbers under control, and I suppose by extension the deaths, with vaccinating the older people and the vulnerable, who we are told are 90% of the deaths, you would be of the opinion that then we need to start opening up our economy and that.
Yeah, well, we need to start opening it up at some point. But if we can control and protect those that are most vulnerable from dying and ending up in hospital, then we're in a much, much better place. And that's what they're doing in many countries like the UK and the US, where they're, and indeed Israel, where they're ahead of us in the vaccine rollout. And that's no criticism of the vaccine rollout here. The big issue here is the supply. And it's a mammoth task trying to vaccinate as many people in the country, but doing it in the correct way. We have to prioritise.
But if our point is not to get to the 80%, which we're hoping to get to by the end of June, but to get, as you say, the hospital situation and to get the vulnerable done, then we get to that point much sooner than the end of June, really, don't we?
Yeah, I think it's important when we look at the daily numbers and we're all see they're really between 400 and 600. What's really important is how many of those people unfortunately end up with severe illness and in hospital or in the ICU. So I think it's important that it's not just the total number of figures, but are we seeing a decline in deaths, which we are certainly in nursing homes, and what are we seeing a decline in significant steady decline in hospital admissions and bad outcomes for those in hospitals.
I have seen a suggestion now that a lot of younger people are getting a lot sicker and ending up in hospital with the new variant. Is that something that you're seeing?
Not a huge amount. The experience, again, on the front line in January and February, that those that were most likely to end up in hospital were older people. So age has a big predictor of poorer outcomes or hospitalizations, but also people with chronic heart disease, chronic lung disease, chronic neurological disease, obesity. They were the patients most likely to get in hospital. And, you know, of course, there are exceptional cases where younger people came in, but they were the exceptions rather than the rule.
OK, well, that's all very encouraging then, isn't it? Now, listen, let's leave aside the bigger picture. So you were talking to Tony Fauci, the US chief medical advisor, this week. You made him an honorary fellow of the College of Physicians. And I know he's a big hero of yours, and we'll talk about why in a minute. Can I just ask you first, did he have anything to say that was relevant? You know, the way we're self-absorbed and obsessed in Ireland? Did he have anything to say that was relevant to our situation, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I asked him what was the message of hope for the people of Ireland, and he made it very clear that vaccination was the hope. The quicker we got the jabs into people's arms, what's known in the US as the Fauci ouchie, we need to get them into people as quickly as possible, and we need to get them into those that are most vulnerable. He did say that we had to follow the science. We had to be able to change track. If the science showed us that, we should be basing decisions on evidence, on the data that's relevant to our situation in Ireland. So he very much said, as we all know, that the science continues to evolve. We don't know everything about the infection. We need to listen. We need to learn. We need to change how we, treat people if new treatments come along. So that's a really, really important message to get out there.
And he seems to be saying as well, we have to be a little bit dispassionate about it as well. Like it has all become quite emotional and personalised at times and stuff. So he's saying, like, we need to stay calm and keep looking at the evidence and change if we need to.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think we really, all the best experts, I'm not too sure if anyone's an expert in COVID. We've learned all along.
Yeah.
But experts in the variants, experts in whole genomic sequencing, our experts in public health, in infectious diseases, respiratory medicine, public health medicine, all getting together. Let's get the best talents, not only here, but the Irish are really good at networking. We have a huge Irish diaspora. Anytime I pick up the phone to any of my colleagues in the UK, like Dr. Susan Hopkins, Dr. Bill Powderly over in St. Louis, where I trained, they are more than willing to help the Irish effort to get us to, a better place. And I have no doubt that we will get to a better place in the coming months. Absolutely no doubt about it. And that was the optimistic message that Dr. Fauci had.
Excellent. You mentioned your training there. I know that Dr. Fauci is a big hero of yours, going back to your early days in medicine when you worked with people with HIV.
That's right. I left on the plane in 1990 to go to St. Louis, Washington University in St. Louis. There was no training in infectious diseases here at the time. And HIV AIDS was a huge issue. It was the commonest cause of death in 25 to 44 year olds at the time.
Where?
In the States.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a huge, huge problem. Wards full of patients. And he spearheaded the effort, and that was the scientific research medical effort in getting to where we are now, which is essentially an infection where you take a tablet a day and your lifespan is normal, which is some achievement. Now, it was like it was really bad for two decades, from the early 80s to the kind of late 90s. But with science, we got out of it, and people forget it. And that's what will happen with this pandemic too. We will get out of it, and we will be in a better place, probably a lot sooner, because we can get the science around it much quicker.
It could be sooner, yeah. Mm. Listen, we were all reminded again of those days, or it was indeed for a lot of us conjured up in a way that we never understood it at the time, by that fantastic drama, It's a Sin, and the awful way that those people ended their lives, and the way they were often estranged from family and alone, locked up in kind of awful places. You did see that kind of thing, didn't you? Like was it in the matter you first would have come across HIV AIDS patients?
Yes, it was. So I trained in UCD in the matter, and I must say the nuns in the matter were fantastic. They really embraced the care of HIV AIDS patients. But it was at a time when it wasn't very clear how the infection was transmitted. There was fear. If one went in to see a patient, wouldn't get it and bring it home? Very similar to what happened with SARS-CoV-2 and COVID back in March. We just didn't know. And, it was those that were most likely to get it were gay men, injecting drug users. And society often can take the higher moral ground and think that these people deserve to get it. That absolutely wasn't the case. an interest.
Was that kind of a common attitude at the time?
It was, say, and yeah. I think it's a sin. If anyone hasn't seen it, they really should watch it. It was like that, but probably much worse. It was the stigma that came with having the infection, not only in large cities, but in small rural communities. And the activism that the gay men did to get to, you know, have science and research and policymakers get us to where we are now is outstanding. They really were the first group to show how activism can and community effort really can get us to a better place. But it was a really difficult time. I remember watching Philadelphia was out at the time, that movie with Tom Hanks in it. And it was so close, so raw. It took me about 10 years to be able to watch that movie. It really was like that. And people need to not forget how bad it was.
Yeah. And those people obviously died very, very lonely deaths. And like was there something about that they had to wear yellow biohazard?
Yeah. So I suppose when I came back, when I came to Cork, because I hadn't worked there before, and this was similar to, it wasn't just Cork. When it came in, there was biohazard stickers, little small yellow stickers on the front of the chart. I ensured that the clinic that I ran wasn't an HIV/AIDS clinic. It was an infectious disease clinic. So it didn't matter what, whether it was hepatitis, malaria, meningitis, recovery, HIV, everyone was seen together. They were all treated the same. And the managers in the hospital were fully supportive in getting rid of the biohazard stickers. We should never do that to anybody, I suppose, target them as if they are different. I mean, our job as doctors and indeed society is to embrace people irrespective of their background, of their sexual preference, and treat them the best way we can.
And I suppose it would have been an unusual and a rare job to be doing in medicine at the time. And when you talk about that stigma, would people have thought that, you know, your family and that, would they have thought that, why were you getting involved in this kind of thing?
No, not at all. My father was a teacher in Tralee, and I suppose he always thought as the privilege that education was and that we had to follow our dream. Because there was no training in Ireland at the time, I decided that I would do what I really wanted to do and go and do it. Were they afraid that if they were, they didn't say it? I had hoped that I would get back to Ireland if to share, I suppose, all the training that I was privileged enough to get in the States, and I did. So I went, follow your dream is what they always
said. And it's
said.
A big medical family as well. So I know the medical families tend to be kind of fairly, I don't know, they're philosophical about illness and death and stuff, aren't they, lots of times?
Yeah, I suppose that's our job, you know.
Yeah. So then you managed to get over the trauma, if you will, of being at the front line of one of the more distressing things in medicine in the past decades, and then go back to the start of last year. Do you remember, like, when you first became aware of COVID? Did you have an idea? Catastrophic it could be.
Well, you know, I'm on the organising committee of the biggest global infectious disease and microbiology meeting, and we had an organising committee to arrange the meeting in Madrid in about the 8th of January. And I just asked one of the people from Hong Kong, you know, what's the story with this new infection out there? Do you know what it is? And she says, well, I think tomorrow they're going to announce that it's a coronavirus. And we'd known about coronaviruses before. They cause the common cold, they cause SARS. And I said, OK, do you think we should maybe have a slot just reserved just in case it becomes an issue for our meeting that was due to be held in the spring? And I think we all agreed that might be a good idea just in case. Yeah. And the rest is history.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned there January and how difficult it was and everything. And presumably you had difficult months last year as well. Has this taken a terrible toll on you and your colleagues on the front line at this stage?
I'm not too sure if toll is the right word. Again, it's our job. We roll up our sleeves, we go in and look after people. It was a challenge in the beginning because we really didn't know what we were dealing with. how best to support patients because all the treatments were new, how we ventilated them and so on. It was amazing how we came together. People we redeployed that weren't normally on wards. We all worked together. The nurses, nurses aides, physiotherapists were absolutely fantastic. Our colleagues. But I suppose at this point, you know, given that we've only been within 5K for the last 3 months, I think a recharge would be very nice in the coming weeks. I'm hoping that there won't be any big fourth wave again because of the vaccination. Has it taken its toll? You know, it's brought us probably closer together. The health service allowed us to be very agile and rapid in adapting to what we felt was important for our patients' needs. Okay. And getting rid of a lot of that red tape allowed things to happen very quickly. Certainly on the front line, that was the experience.
And I didn't know this, but you have a son who has autism, is autistic.
That's right.
And, how has it been for him?
Well, Declan is, how has it been? I suppose a bit challenging. So the cinemas are closed. He likes to go to the church. He likes to go to the bookshops and libraries. So they're all closed. So his world has contracted a little bit. But saying that, he works down in the library in UCC, and Donna and all the team down there have been so supportive and really integrated into the important job that he has down there. So
that's fantastic he has a job. So many people in his position don't. How old is he?
Absolutely. He is 28.
Okay. So when he was a child, I think people are very autism aware now and everything.
Yes.
We all understand a lot more. I presume it was very different 20, 25 years ago, was it?
Yes, it was. You know, the facilities here to diagnose it at the time, the supports that were present weren't as plentiful, if that's even the right word now, because I'm not too sure if they're that plentiful. But it was, you know, difficult to navigate the system, and I'd be fairly articulate, and I not only do I advocate for my patients, but certainly advocate for my son and people with intellectual disability. So it was a challenging time, but I was really fortunate to meet fantastic teachers in Scullowen and Colossia Cullen, Mr. Kinsella, who was the principal there, who really had the vision of integrating people with intellectual disability or special needs within the school and the schools there. And, you know, not only does that help people with intellectual disability bring them up to that level, but it also gives, if you want to call normal kids, the understanding of you do need to be patient. We're, you know, it's one society that we live in.
Yeah. That's and listen, Isn't it so true that, like, you can get lucky and meet the right person along your journey, and it makes all the difference in the world, doesn't it? Listen, on another note, you also became a COVID advisor to the World Rugby and to the GAA. So a lot of people will want to know what your thoughts are now on the future of sport over the next months.
Clearly sports is really important for the health and well-being of those that play it. But even us watching it at home, it's so nice to be able to watch something like rugby at the moment.
Is anyone going to go to a match anytime soon?
I think if we can get our players back even training, that would be a big plus. I mean, most sports are outdoors activity, and outdoor risk of acquiring infection is so much less than indoor congregate settings. So at least if we were to do it stepwise and safe and sustainably, it would be great to see our kids and young people back playing outdoors sports again. And indeed, other people out playing golf. I mean, it's wide open. We have a great country, loads of good outdoor facilities. You have to go through any town, our village in the country, and there's a GAA pitch.
Yeah, okay. You see, people are going to be reading between the lines and all that now and thinking, great, she's going to go into the NPHET meeting on Monday, is it? And she'll be pushing for sports. Speaking of you being on NPHET, so you were only on NPHET since the beginning of this year. You were co-opted on. Did it kind of came out of a kind of a Twitter to-do between you and Killian de Gascoigne, kind of, didn't it? Where you I think, basically argued that the B.1.1.7 variant, we needed to take it very, very seriously, and it was going to be a big problem.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, you know, Killian is a good friend. So we do what scientists do is debate. I suppose I have 30 years experience in infectious diseases, and certainly by background, it was in virology. And I know viruses, they mutate, the variants become more of an issue. I'm well aware of the importance of whole genomic sequencing. I suppose what I bring really to NPHET is my frontline experience that we just discussed. I suppose I've 3 years in, 3 decades in infectious diseases. And also importantly, as president of the largest postgraduate training body, it was really important that that educational piece gets disseminated out to all of the practitioners that are out there, The science changes so quickly. So having that and working with my colleagues who've worked hugely in the past year to try to navigate through what is an ever-evolving situation, I felt that, it was important that I could contribute to the public health doctors on it in whatever way I can.
And you know what? Judging by the texters here to 51551, what a lot of people want to know is, what can they do after they get their vaccination? Can you please ask your expert what you can do after you've had your second jab? My 88-year-old mother thinks she can go shopping and have a neighbour in for a cup of tea. Please ask Dr. Horgan, after receiving the vaccines, will we be able to mix freely with other people who got the vaccine and no longer wear a mask? And there are actually several more along those lines.
Well, I'm in that situation too. I'd like to get the guidance on what I can do.
You've had two jabs.
Yes. I had two jabs way back in the 29th of December when it started back in Cork. My understanding is that advice will be coming on that. Certainly those that are fully vaccinated, and about 14 days after full vaccination, the protection is outstanding, much, much better than we even thought was going to be, of preventing deaths and preventing severe infection and hospitalisation. So I'm hoping, no different than your listeners, that we get guidance, that those that are fortunate that are vaccinated will know what to be able to do.
I think Dr. Glynn has said there will be some guidance forthcoming on Monday, but he would seem to be kind of playing down what options there might be. Like say we forget for a minute that you're a member of NPHET. Two people who both had both vaccines having a cup of tea.
Well, we have to go with the current public health guidelines, but the risk is going to be low. And the Centre for Disease Control in the US have come out with guidelines on what the incentive, what's the vaccine bonus that we can do. And I think that's important for us to be working on now, so the 88-year-old mother can go shopping, meet and hug her grandkids. So that guidance will be very, very welcome.
Yeah, OK. Listen, just... before you go, in a broad way, because you are an optimist and everything, and I know you've said in the past we need to go back to a 70s or 80s mindset where we weren't jetting off to the sun every 5 minutes, and I think we've all possibly thought about how casual we were about travel. In terms of how the next months, the summer and that pans out, and I know this is an impossible question, but you might have a stab at it. People have this obsession with normal. When will my life be back to some kind of normal? Do you see that on the horizon?
What I see is that there will be public health measures. I think masking will be around for a while, which has some additional advantages since we didn't see flu and kids weren't getting sick this year. Uh-huh. So I think those measures about not being in crowded situations, wearing masks still will continue. But I do see in the next few months, and in the US they're hoping the 4th of July, because their vaccine rollout is a bit quicker, that it will be a lot better once, as I said, we get those jabs into those people who are most likely to end up in hospital.
Okay. Professor Mary Horgan, thank you very much.